Your Excellencies, Ambassadors and High Commissioners, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, esteemed colleagues and fellow learners here at LSE, a warm welcome to this evening's public lecture. My name is Danny Kwa. I'm Professor of Economics and International Development here at LSE and Director of the Saw Swee Hock Southeast Asia Center. And it's my pleasure to welcome you this evening and to host our distinguished speaker, Khun Abhisit Wachachiwa, 27th Prime Minister of the Kingdom of Thailand and leader of the Thai Democrat Party. Khun Abhisit has, of course, a long acquaintance with England, and he and I were a few minutes ago discussing his experience with LSE. I fervently believe that he had previously lectured in this very building, but he's given so many lectures, it's a little bit of a blur. As you know, he had also attended Eton in his youth and then studied PPE and economics at Oxford. Khun Abhisit was elected to Parliament in Thailand, aged only 27, and then became one of Thailand's youngest ever prime ministers in 2008, which you'll remember was the midst of the global financial crisis, a worldwide event that resulted from an immediate shock of mortgage defaults across and massive breakdowns in financial systems in the West. Those disruptions, economic and financial, have continued in many parts of the world, not least here in Europe itself, with an ongoing sovereign debt and economic crisis. Unfortunately, economic and political turmoil are also what comes to many observers' minds when they think about Thailand in this last decade. Southeast Asia overall has seen a varied range of experiences post-2008. Now, I say all this to remind us, here at the Southeast Asia Center, we have worked hard to raise in the UK understanding of developments in Southeast Asia generally, and of ASEAN in particular. To that end, the Southeast Asia Center has also organized a Southeast Asia Forum to be held here at LSE next month, Friday the 13th of May. And that forum will bring together academics, policymakers, stakeholders of all kinds. It will be a unique opportunity for all to engage with Southeast Asia's most critical issues, to network with renowned experts on the region, and to encourage further student participation in important high-level debates. Against that background, we are pleased and honored indeed that Khun Abhisit has come to LSE this evening to speak on rebranding ASEAN as a global player. He has agreed to speak for 45 minutes and has kindly agreed to participate in a question and answer session the remainder of the time that we get to have him here at LSE. Because of other engagements, he will have to leave at 8 p.m. and the session will end just a little bit before then. Just some final bookkeeping items. Please put your mobile phones on silent if they are not already so. At LSE, we like to participate in an ongoing conversation, and part of that conversation involves people who have been unable to come this evening. And that conversation involves, among other things, live tweeting events. So even if you've put your mobile phone on silent, please feel free to tweet about this event using the hashtag LSE Thailand. And just to remind everyone, both the public lecture and the question and answer session are being recorded. And I hope the podcast will be available soon afterwards. And it is vitally important for the integrity of that podcast that your mobile phones do not go off in the middle of the recording. All that as background, if you could join me now in welcoming to the podium Khun Abhisit.
Thank you very much for a very kind introduction. Actually, we were discussing my experience with this institution, the London School of Economics. One point of contention was whether I actually spoke here. I recall actually coming here to see Khun Gorn, the former finance minister in my cabinet, being the main speaker. Whether that actually got me involved in the discussion for a short period of time is something we could not remember. But it's a great pleasure to be here, because the other experience that I discussed with Professor Kwa was that it feels good to be invited by the London School of Economics. The reason being was when I was a young man, I actually applied to the London School of Economics for my first and also for my master's degree. I never even got a letter of reply. So to be invited here today is a great pleasure to speak in front of all of you and on a very special topic, which is ASEAN. But as always, when I'm asked to speak about ASEAN, whether in Thailand or in other places, I find it always a little difficult to gauge how much people in the audience know or are familiar with ASEAN. So maybe I really should start with a straw poll. How many of you think you're familiar with ASEAN? Please put your hands up. Well, I'm glad when Gorn puts his hand up. So I take that as a small minority. Okay. Well, of those of you who are familiar with ASEAN, how many of you view ASEAN as a global power? One, two, don't be shy. Maybe three. Well, I think that says a lot about the topic that I've been asked to speak upon, which is, I think many of you recognize the importance and the potential of ASEAN, and yet there somehow has always been a gap between that potential and what, at least a perception of what ASEAN has achieved despite being in existence now for almost 50 years. And what I would like to do during the 45 minutes is to maybe take you through my train of thought about how ASEAN has evolved, the historical development, give some kind of assessment as to how I see the success or lack of ASEAN, what the challenges are today, and the main thrust of my talk will be on what it needs for ASEAN to really become a global power. And I should say at the outset that the word rebranding might be slightly misleading, because I think what I propose would be seen to be much more than just a rebrand, but maybe repositioning or maybe somehow change the paradigm of how ASEAN works. And then, of course, you're welcome to ask extensively during the Q&A. I know that there may be some questions that are not directly related to what I will say in the next 40, 45 minutes. But given the political situation back home, the rules are that you are responsible for your questions. I'm only responsible for my answers, right? And I have asked for this to be recorded to make sure that there are no misreports about what I say, okay? So back to ASEAN. I think one of the things that we need to recognize is that these days we look at regional integration from a very different perspective than many of these regional arrangements start when these regional arrangements started. So, for instance, everybody talks about the European Union, often forgetting that to get here, the European countries had been through a very small arrangement on coal and steel, and then to a free trade, and then to an economic community, common currency, and then the Union. Likewise, so much talk about the ASEAN community, which was formally established a few months ago, the focus is so much on the economic community. In fact, if you come from Thailand, when we talk about the ASEAN community in Thailand, nobody ever talks using the words ASEAN community. It's always been AEC, which in fact is only one of the three pillars of the ASEAN community. The other two, of course, being the political and security pillar and also the socio-cultural pillar. So I think it's important to recognize that, because one of the main points that I would like to drive home today is that to be a true community requires so much more than whatever technical or economic agreements leaders of the member countries come up with. And that's where I think the ASEAN leaders, governments, and peoples need to be aware of if they really want to achieve their potential and act as a true global power. Of course, along the way, there will be inevitable comparisons with the experience here in the European Union. And, of course, here in the UK, you are about to engage in a referendum which will decide whether the United Kingdom remains in the Union or not, which is a historic decision and also points the way as to how ASEAN needs to be aware of how to get integration right. And I'll have some observations about that as well. But back in 1967, when this all started, the aim of ASEAN was very simple. There was a threat of communism in the region. Countries within the region were at war. And the five founding members were determined to cooperate to make sure that each of the five countries can get on with her development process without, you know, falling as dominoes in the communist expansion. And for the five countries to join together to ensure that there is that threat is contained, that there is peace, security, and eventually with a vision that down the line, the 10 Southeast Asian nations would all come together and join this organization. So in that sense, ASEAN, with its original aim, has been successful. But it wasn't really about being a global player. It was about making sure that the conditions, the environment in the region is right for countries to move ahead with their own development process, to have peace and to have prosperity. It was only a few decades ago, 3 decades ago, that the focus then shifted to economic integration, notably with the agreement to have a free trade area in 1992. And again, the primary aim was still to make sure that all Southeast Asian nations joined the organization, which was finally achieved. But once the shift was to the economic cooperation and integration, ASEAN was also lucky to count on its strong fundamentals. The region, as part of East Asia, but particularly in Southeast Asia, had a good record of economic growth and stability. The unfortunate thing, of course, was that in 1997, that was disrupted by the financial crisis that hit Thailand and Indonesia in particular. But even then, people recognize that both countries and the region were pretty quick to bounce back from the crisis and therefore demonstrated the resilience of the region as well. And again, in 2008, that experience was repeated when the Southeast Asian region as a whole was not badly hit by the global financial crisis and again was able to emerge from the crisis relatively quickly without turning inwards. In fact, ASEAN went one better. During that period of crisis, ASEAN moved ahead with opening up the region by completing free trade agreements with the key dialogue partners, the plus six, China, Korea, Japan, India, New Zealand, and Australia. And so in many ways, you could say that there has been a history of success. One of the feeling that I had when I was chair of ASEAN that demonstrated this success was, of course, we expanded the East Asia Summit, which was the ASEAN plus six, the six countries I've mentioned, was expanded to include the United States and Russia. And I recalled vividly that when I was in Brussels for the ASEM meeting, the Asia-Europe leaders meeting, many European countries actually began asking me how they might join the East Asia Summit, to which my reply was, it takes a stretch of the imagination to include Europe as part of East Asia. But we were nevertheless happy to explore ways in which we could strengthen our cooperation. But despite this record of success, ASEAN has always come under pretty heavy criticisms, especially from the West. I recall that it was always noted that the ASEAN summit meeting, meeting ASEAN leaders, you know, the Western press would say, well, there's a lot of talk, not much happens. And in the end, there were only three things, in the old days anyway, that happened. One, the leaders played golf together. Two, they eat durians. And three, they shake hands in a funny way. And it was a reflection of the feeling that somehow ASEAN wasn't doing things the way the rest of the world expects it to do things. Agreements have to be achieved via consensus, which meant, of course, that it only takes one member to say no for any proposal to be shot down. And, of course, the ASEAN way, as it was dubbed, was interpreted to mean that there would be no interference with internal matters of other members, and therefore it was felt that a lot was being left off the table. And indeed, when Myanmar was very much criticized and alienated by the West, that became a stumbling block in terms of engaging ASEAN with the rest of the world. But now that actually Myanmar has become one of the brightest spots in terms of political developments in ASEAN, there will continue to be a debate whether ASEAN was right in her approach to the Myanmar issue. I recall the words of the former ASEAN Secretary General, Dr. Surin Pitsuan, who I thought eloquently summarized the difference between the ASEAN approach to the Myanmar problem than the West, was that we didn't have the luxury of distance. And therefore, to expect us to adopt an approach of sanctions or alienation just didn't make sense. And there has to be some kind of flexible engagement in order to encourage internal change in Myanmar. but we wouldn't engage in making public statements that would embarrass, that would make member countries lose face. But behind closed doors, certainly at all ASEAN meetings that I've been to, the issue of Myanmar was discussed. Other members would be asking Myanmar to tell them how much progress they've made along the roadmap that she has set for herself. But enough of the Myanmar problem, because who am I coming from Thailand to comment on Myanmar's roadmap to democracy? I'll leave it at that. Each country will have to find her own path towards sustainable development and also political system. And, you know, I say in a mocking way about Thailand, it's also, I think, worth noting that most of the ASEAN countries will still have to deal with some kind of political transition. From one party polity to multi-party polities. You know, even countries like Singapore will be more challenged on how to move towards a more multi-party system. Cambodia, Malaysia, and Thailand, of course, I've already mentioned. And Laos, Vietnam, in opening up, will also have to go through some kind of political transition. But as I say, it's hard for outsiders to understand what we call the ASEAN way. But there is certainly something in the ASEAN way that has been able to make sure that we have evolved the way we have. And there has been a degree of success. But at the same time, now that the focus is on economic integration, and also I think objectives, goals are being set out, those of you familiar with the blueprint of the ASEAN economic community with the 2015, the four main goals of making sure that the region is well integrated in terms of trade and investment, of making sure that there is also the goal of equity, bringing along the less developed members to make sure that there isn't a gap that opens up, to make sure that the grouping is competitive, and also to make sure that we are open to global changes. That is now being reinforced by the 2025 blueprint, which I think adds the issue of connectivity as one of the main challenges for the economic community roadmap. And if you look at some figures, you could argue that, yes, ASEAN is still moving forward and is on course to achieve continued economic success. The size of the population of ASEAN is, well, half of China or half of India. That makes it quite a huge market. The size of the economy itself, if ASEAN were a country, would be ranked 7th in the world or 3rd in Asia. The volume of trade, 1 trillion. And one of the key advantages as ASEAN moves forward is the population structure, where about half the population is actually youth, compared to 40% maybe in East Asia as a whole, and about 30% in Europe. So we've got a young workforce, young population still emerging, with the exception, of course, of Singapore and Thailand, which are transforming into aging societies fairly rapidly. But so there's a lot going for it, and I've already mentioned that ASEAN has completed all the free trade agreements with the key dialogue partners, now engaged in negotiations to set up the RCEP, which will include all the ASEAN plus six into an economic partnership. And also many other initiatives that are being taken at the moment to strengthen this grouping. And yet, if you look deep, into this, you can't help but feel a bit uncertain or frustrated about how all this can be classified as an unqualified success. Somehow, despite the numbers of growth rates that I've mentioned, or the growth of trade or investment, there are still some numbers that basically tell the story that ASEAN is not as well integrated as it should be. For instance, despite the volume of trade, only 20% of ASEAN trade is actually intra-ASEAN. A comparable figure for Europe would be, I think, 60%. And it's roughly the same percentage in terms of intra-ASEAN investment as well. So that suggests that there is still some way to go. I talk about RCEP. Many people would feel that already that's been overtaken by the progress that TPP has made, with also some of the member countries being part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And if all the ratification process goes well, that means that within a year or two, there will be a number of member countries within ASEAN that is left out of this partnership and will, I guess, be also seeking alternatives at the unilateral or bilateral levels as well. But more important than that, if you look at or view ASEAN, not just dealing with the problems that all member states face in terms of the challenges of economic development and growth, but common problems. I'll just give you three examples. Number one, every year we suffer from the haze, but we have not seen a regional solution to this very problem. Still very much the burden is shifted onto the host country without a modality of how the region might tackle this problem. The Rohingyas problem. Again, it's been hard to put together a regional. In fact, it needs more than just ASEAN, but our Western neighbors as well to join in to be able to effectively tackle this problem. The South China Seas, which has been the one issue that actually succeeded in disrupting a joint statement in ASEAN. That's never happened before. Again, somehow we don't see a clear regional stance being taken on these issues that matter to the whole region. And it makes you pause for thought. If ASEAN aspires to be a global player, we have to be seen to take some common stance. We have to be seen to be able to come up with a regional solution to regional problems. A community or a global player is just not simply about what individual countries or member countries achieve. Somehow, the region as a whole has to have some kind of identity and stance. And that's where I think ASEAN has been falling short. And it's something that needs to be fixed very quickly. I mentioned that if you compare with the European Union or the European experience, that's, I think, where you see a huge gap still existing. Today, all the European countries face a huge challenge about the migrants from Africa, from the Middle East, grappling with the issue of terrorism. But from the outside, we see European leaders working towards a European solution, referencing the principles to some kind of European values. That's why the EU is a global player. It's not about what the French or the Germans or the British or the Italians think or want to deal with the issue. That is actually a European stance on these issues. And you look at the working of the European Union, clearly the leaders of member countries are the ones that are driving the European Union work. Chancellor in Germany obviously has had a very strong and leading role in doing so. But she's not really seen as representing Germany as much as representing what Europe stands for. But when you look at ASEAN and the ASEAN summits, it's very rare to see that kind of working style or leadership being demonstrated at the political level. Which is why there are some of the things that you can do to try to bring the region together, to make it more integrated, to make it a true community, in order to make it a true global player. Some things are not too difficult to do. The issue of connectivity, for one, is something that was easily agreed upon. The more connected we are among ourselves, the better chance we have of achieving true integration and making sure that our peoples take full advantage of the community. You'll be maybe shocked to learn that even the free trade area, you will find that many local companies are still not yet taking up on the benefits of the AFTA. They don't think it's worth the trouble to go through the process to have the gains from the free trade area. You stop at any border between two ASEAN countries, it's too far from being seamless, the way you can travel around Europe and cross borders without actually noticing that you're now in a different country. That's something that I think we need to fix, and we can fix fairly fast. Connectivity is high on the agenda, it's now being included in the blueprint, but it will also need domestic political support and perspective. Again, the issue of the rail link has been a policy, public policy issue in Thailand now for five, six years, three governments, and yet we don't have a decision to move ahead with how we're going to get rail from southern China to Singapore. The latest is that we'll get sections between China and Laos, and in Thailand, Bangkok to Nakhon Ratchasima, and Malaysia and Singapore doing their own thing. So that's something that I think can be fixed. Not too difficult a challenge. There are things that I think we need to encourage more, getting the private sector to think about having a common ASEAN brand on some of the products where the region has a competitive edge. I can think of the pharmaceutical industry, the electronics industry, the automobile industry, where we might have to think about some kind of ASEAN brand. And even easier than that, you know, every now and then we have the Southeast Asian Games. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Somebody asked me, why don't we call it the ASEAN Games? Okay, there is East Timor as well, but surely we want to somehow make people identify ASEAN and being part of ASEAN more. And that's why I think ultimately, if ASEAN wants to be a global player, it can't just bank on its strong fundamentals or maybe fortunate history. You know, the East Asia Summit, the ASEAN Regional Forum has been helpful to the global challenges, but partly because it's easier to have countries in ASEAN around the table that reduces the tension between the superpowers. Mm. So we've contributed to the problem, the solution to the Korean Peninsula whenever there are talks that are needed. We can, you know, have Japan, China, the U.S. and now Russia around the table without feeling that there's a confrontation because there are other member ASEAN countries again. But we need to move beyond that and actually create an ASEAN that is a global player in our own right. And to do that, the one thing that has been missing is somehow we have to create this sense of common values and common destiny. I mean, I see so many faces here that come from countries in ASEAN. But if I were to ask you a question, do you feel that you are ASEAN? I'm not sure how many hands would go up. You'd identify yourself as Thai, Singaporean, Malaysian, Filipino, ASEAN? I'm not so sure. That's what we need. And these common values and destiny can only be arrived at through a political process. It's not about technocrats drafting agreements that leaders can sign. But it will take political will for the ASEAN government leaders to say there is an ASEAN beyond a collection of 10 individual countries. And we need to find an identity for that entity. Now, how are we going to go about that? What would define what the ASEAN identity is important. But if you look at the European experience, okay, they had the advantage of domestic political stability in its original members. But eventually, there is no moving away from having people directly participating and engaging in regional affairs. And you have to concede that ordinary people in the 10 countries have very little to do with the ASEAN agenda in the past. It was all about the political leaders and the technocrats. Europe eventually has to have a European parliament where the peoples of the member countries can be represented and take some decisions on how Europe as a whole moves ahead. Well, ASEAN may not have to go, you know, take the full model of Europe, but we need to engage. But it hasn't been easy. I recall that when Thailand was chair of ASEAN, we wanted to make sure that whenever there is an ASEAN summit or leaders meeting, we engage youth, we engage parliamentarians, and we engage civil society. But we tried that and ran straight into trouble. One of the leaders of an ASEAN country, when Thailand wanted to have this meeting, complained that he was not happy with his country's representative of civil society. He wanted to choose his own. And that was the first for me. And when I've heard about governments being elected by people, this is asking people to be elected by governments. Eventually, we sort of compromised. But then the next year, when the chairmanship was passed on to a different country, the practice was stopped. Surely that can't go on forever if we really want to create a true community. So some kind of engagement with the peoples, direct participation, is needed. And that means that there has to be political will on the part of individual leaders to take this message back to the people that we need your involvement in the ASEAN agenda, ASEAN project, so ASEAN can actually truly represent the 600 or so million people and not just a collection of people. It's a community. And you may ask, well, how do we go about that? Do we need to fully import models from the West or other regions. So for instance, another example, during our chairmanship also, we pushed for the existence of a human rights commission. It now exists in some form, but it has also still very limited mandate. So it would not be in the position, like in other regions, to actually monitor and try to correct rights abuses. So there are options. You could either try to emulate or import the models of the West to create some kind of values, common values, to move ahead, but it will be difficult. Perhaps a more realistic option is, why don't we actually explore or probe a little further about what we and the rest of the world call the ASEAN way? Can we somehow develop that concept into common values, into a sense of common destiny for the 10 Southeast Asian nations? I say this because, you know, when I talked to the European colleagues, I was often amazed at how important the European Union is to the European people. We tend to think about the success of integration on technical economic agreements. But for me, that's not really the story. Do you recall a few years ago, people thought that maybe the union was going to be torn apart because of the crisis in Greece, and even before that in Portugal and other countries. And, you know, people started talking about lessons about the common currency. Well, which is nice because, you know, when I was chair of ASEAN, the Western press used to ask me about the lack of ambition in ASEAN. Why don't you go for a common currency? You know, being an economist, I try to explain to them about the need for harmonization of fiscal monetary policies. I'm not sure they understood it. But after Greece, they never asked again. So I reminded them, why aren't you asking me about the common currency anymore? But so it's not about and I think the important lesson that I draw from the crisis is that you should be impressed with the European determination to stay together. Why should the Greeks accept incredible austerity measures, cutting people's income maybe in half, simply because they wanted to remain in Europe? Why should German taxpayers be propping up banks in other countries simply because they want to keep Europe together? That's the lesson. And so I asked the European colleagues, why is it important for Europe to stay together? And actually my expectation was, well, you know, economically it makes sense. You're going to be able to be a bigger player in the world economy. But no. The Europeans tell me they want to stay together because they think the union has brought them peace. And they are proud to have certain values, human rights, environmental awareness, conscience, and they think that's what's keeping them, or should be keeping them, together. Which brings me to Brexit. Because I always remember people asking, do you think Greece will leave the EU? And I said, well, you know, if you argue on pure economic terms, there is very good argument for countries to leave the EU. Actually, one of the easiest solutions would be for Germany to leave the EU so that the others don't have to be so disciplined in their monetary policy. But, no, the issue is... you need to have people wanting to be part of the community or part of the union. Right? And I ask a hypothetical question. Suppose we had some kind of arrangements or agreements in ASEAN, and suppose one of the countries in ASEAN now has to face a kind of austerity measure being demanded by ASEAN. Do you think that country would stay in ASEAN? I'm not so sure. If one of the ASEAN countries were asked to bear the financial burden of keeping the region together, do you think it would be willing to do that? I'm not so sure. So it's all about feeling part of that community. And when I said that brings me to Brexit, was when I was asked about Greece leaving the EU, I always reply that I'm more concerned that the UK would leave the EU. And they say, why? And I said, because I spent 10 years of my life in Britain. And I always felt that the British never really felt that they are part of Europe. Not continental Europe. They actually feel they're better than continental Europe. And therein lies the problem. With different legal traditions and systems, the British were always uncomfortable with having things dictated from Brussels and a feeling that somehow that their sovereignty has been encroached upon, that somehow there is something undemocratic about Brussels imposing the regulations, the will on the British people. And you will see that throughout the history of the European Union, the UK is always seen as a country that is reluctant to join, that looks always for exceptions, right? The Euro, Schengen, and so on. So for me, the lesson for ASEAN is, if we want to make sure that we become a true community, that we stick together in order to become a global player, we need to make sure that all our 10 members feel that it's important to belong to ASEAN, that they are involved in the ASEAN agenda and actually sets the path for ASEAN to become a regional entity and a global player. And when I say we should explore the ASEAN way or revisit the ASEAN way to see how we can develop that, it's because I recognize that the way we do things will definitely be different from the way the Western and other regional arrangements do things. But we need to come up with something, and we should do it fast. With the economic agreements easily overtaken by other, you know, super free trade deals, with China pushing with One Belt, One Road, and still dealing with member countries on an individual basis on that issue and also on the South China Sea issue, the ASEAN identity will just slip away unless we do something about it. So my call is for leaders of the ASEAN countries to recognize this and build it into their own domestic agenda, that there is now a need to find a common identity, sense of destiny, and common values for ASEAN, and somehow come up with this to make sure that we do become a global player, which I maintain is something is well within the grasp and the potential of ASEAN. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Khun Abhisit, for a really wonderful, thoughtful lecture filled with realism about what ASEAN is like out there, but at the same time optimistic and hopeful and truly democratic in the truest sense of appealing to broad swaths of the population, not just, you know, a cabal of elites building a structure. So thank you very much. I would like to open this now to questions. And once again, if you missed the beginning, all of this is being recorded. It would be best if, when you get up to ask a question, you identify yourself briefly, and then please make it a question. Don't deliver your own mini lecture. I would like to have as much participation as possible. So when I call on you, wait for the microphones from either Lei or Jenny to come around to you. Stand up, identify yourself, ask your question, and then we've agreed that we will take the questions in clusters of three or four, and then I will hand over to Khun Abhisit to respond. So questions, please. Okay. So I'll have one of you first, then I'll come back for the other. So just one of you.
Good evening. It's an honor to have you here. So over half of the ASEAN population are below 30 years old. You can say that these or the young individuals play a monumental role when it comes to shaping the region forward. Given your extensive leadership experience, as MP when you're 27 and becoming the Prime Minister of Thailand when you're 40 years old, what kind of advice can you give to young individuals here from around the region, from elsewhere, when it comes to shaping the region towards a better, brighter path?
Thank you very much. Thank you. What advice for the young people? Now, someone from another geography other than here? And I would like to encourage gender distribution as well, if I may. Okay. In the meantime, the gentleman in the middle, and then I'll come back to you. Behind you. Did you have your hand up? No, okay. All right, I'll come back. Go ahead, sir.
Hi there, I'm Charles Small. I'm an ex-LSE student. And I wanted to ask, as ASEAN integrates into the world as a global player through the ASEAN Plus X free trade agreements, it seems that there's a bit of an issue of collective responsibility, and which I think you touched upon with the Greece crisis in the EU. Just using the example of the EU-Thailand free trade agreement negotiations, which have been on hold for a little while, there seems to be so much scope for an ASEAN-EU free trade agreement, but I don't think that can really go ahead without all 10 ASEAN economies involved. How much willpower do you think there is within the ASEAN countries to encourage leaders to solve issues like this collectively?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. One more question before I hand over. Okay, yes. Okay, go ahead, sir.
Hello, my name is Warot Senapitak. I'm a second-year student at the London School of Economics. I'm studying politics and economics. So you talk, I thank you very much for speaking today. I really agree with your views here, but you talk about the ASEAN identity and how this must be done as soon as possible. The question is, are domestic members really well-placed to tackle this, especially given the situation in, say, Burma and in Thailand, for example? Are they really well-placed to do this bottom-up change towards this ASEAN value? And if not, what kind of solutions do you suggest? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. While you gather your thoughts on the next round of questions, I'm going to turn to Khun Abhisit to take these first three. So on the first of these, perhaps the advice for the young.
Yeah.
But how you would...
Well, I was just thinking that if you make up about 50% or more of the population, we should be seeking advice from you. And you're going to be the ones that will live with the consequences of how the community evolves. No, I think what I hope to have from youth is that because you grow up in a post-globalization, if you like, I just hope that you have a different perspective on things, which is more open, more international, more global. Many of us here grew up in an environment where, you know, if you wanted to know anything, you know, beyond your immediate neighborhood, it was almost impossible. But, you know, youth and this generation has grown up with almost the world at their fingertips. So I hope that you bring the more open and international outlook into the way that we deal with things at the national or domestic level. I mean, you could look around the ASEAN countries and look at the political dialogue and debates and see how so much of the global context is still being left out, despite the realities of the integration that happens in the world. That's got to change, and it's that change is easily driven by youth and much more difficult to be driven by, you know, the older generations. So take advantage of that, and of course take advantage of the connectivity in various forms to gain and learn, you know, experience. You'll be surprised, for instance, at how much people in Thailand know about, say, European countries, about the United States, than they know about their immediate neighbors, unless they live along the border and have a tradition of, you know, exchanges across the border. That's got to change for the region to be well integrated and to have some kind of common identity. So, you know, my advice, for instance, for youth in Thailand is that you should learn, you should be able to use Thai, to use English, and also one other language, preferably in ASEAN. Mm. So that will bring people together. The second question on the free trade negotiations, I've been trying for 2 years now to convince the European counterparts that they are making a huge mistake in not going ahead with the technical negotiations, and for no good reasons, because the framework of negotiations was approved by an elected parliament. Why waste time? You can go ahead with all the technical negotiations, and we're fine with them, with you holding off on the signing until there is an elected government. But what's the sense in just wasting, what, 2-3 years? And then when an elected government comes in, you still have all that hard work to do on a technical negotiations. That's a huge mistake. Mm. And in fact, if you did complete the technical negotiations, you'd be even putting more pressure on Thailand to return to democracy, because as soon as we return to democracy, we have the immediate benefit of being able to sign the free trade agreement. Okay? But that's the problem with the European way. Mm. The hard and fast rules and the feeling that, oh, well, there's been a coup, we need to cut off engagement and so on. When you know, you could have a much more flexible solution without compromising on principles. Whether we could use the ASEAN-EU negotiations instead, I think that's probably a lot more difficult. I mean, it's been tried, and it's not easy, given the diversity of the economic structures within the 10 countries, to push that ahead. And involving the various countries to that kind of agreement or partnership is unlikely to overtake the RCEP negotiations in terms of priorities. So I think it would be difficult. But, you know, going back again, I think I've been urging the European counterparts to rethink their stance on suspending the negotiations. Are individual countries well placed given our political constraints? Well, you know something, sometimes you could use regional or global excuses to affect changes domestically. Mm. I think I can say this. I met with a Malaysian minister last year, and we had a conversation about the TPP with the stringent conditions on issues like state enterprises, intellectual property rights, and I was saying, isn't that going to be difficult for you? And the reply that I got from him was that, well, it's a difficult domestic issue. It might be made easier if the government says we need the benefits from the TPP, we have to move ahead with state enterprise reform, because that's part of the conditions. So I can see opportunities for individual governments struggling to reform some institutions or policies that can actually use ASEAN, a common ASEAN agenda, as an excuse. You know, there's so much awareness and enthusiasm now for reforms, bureaucratic reforms in countries like Thailand, because we feel that unless we do that, we're not going to be able to take advantage of the ASEAN integration. So if political leaders are smart enough, they can play this off against one another in terms of domestic and regional challenges, and find ways of effective changes that would be difficult if you totally separate the domestic and the regional. And also you can try and find stakeholders and begin to build up a coalition for some key changes by appealing to some kind of common regional agenda that's been agreed upon.
Excellent.
If you wait until all the 10 countries are doing well politically, you're going to wait a long time. So we should move ahead.
Yeah. Okay, while people are waiting, one of you, I'll come back to you. While people are sort of gathering their thoughts, I would like to get the three. Perhaps I could use chair's privilege and ask you a question, sir. One of the things along the way that you had mentioned was you were critical of how the People's Republic seems to have implicitly or otherwise taken on a divide and conquer approach. It has not, in One Belt, One Road, dealt with ASEAN as a bloc. It has tried to negotiate and collaborate with individual countries. But I wonder if ASEAN itself has to bear some of the blame for this too. Very unfortunately, the Philippine-China dispute in the South China Sea has had to go to international arbitration, and sort of taking that away from ASEAN to decide, to take a position. It became a bilateral issue rather than a genuinely multilateral one. So perhaps, you know, ASEAN too needs to shoulder the responsibility, implicit in what you say already, in behaving more like a true community rather than being opportunistic. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we have to bear some of the blame as well.
Well, I should set the record straight. It wasn't a criticism, it was an observation.
Okay.
That China is still dealing with many of these issues
point
on
taken.
A bilateral
yep.
basis. It's reality. Mm. And in the case of the South China Sea, you can see the rationale for that from the point of view of China.
Mm.
There shouldn't be any questions
yeah.
about why they should do that.
Absolutely.
But the One Belt, One Road, and the connectivity issue. Mm-hmm. I think certainly I've been frustrated by the lack of a true regional forum to get things done. You know, even the rail link, we've never even had a meeting between Laos, Thailand, and China. We have to keep asking what's happening in Laos, and I'm sure people in Laos are asking, well, what's happening in Thailand? When in fact the project would be feasible or not. Is very much dependent on both sections being completed and connecting to each other.
Yeah.
So it's odd. But the South China Sea issue, I should say that has been made more complicated since the United States wants to really get involved. I don't know if I offended any American.
That's okay, offend away.
I don't intend to apologize. So, I'm just wondering whether I have offended. I think the United States, since she's been involved in the East Asia Summit, has tried to encourage, shall we say, the claimants, the ASEAN claimants, to somehow build a coalition and take a common stance and get ASEAN involved. Which for me is not necessarily the right way to go about it. I don't think that it is the job of ASEAN to try to settle the dispute as a bloc. What I think ASEAN's job is about making sure that, number one, there is safe passage in the area for the benefit of all. Two, that whatever solutions that are come up with are done so through peaceful means and in accordance with international law. I think that's. I'd like to see some kind of common ASEAN stance, and in a forceful way, but leave it at that. And the dispute should be left to the claimants.
Okay, interesting. Okay, no, you had been very patient. So if I could come back to you now, and then two other people. So go ahead, sir.
Hi, good evening. Thank you very much, Mr. Kunabizit and Professor, for chairing the session. It's quite an honor to finally meet you and listen to your lecture in person. My name is Fadli. I also study PPE at the University of Essex. I'm from Brunei. My friend here, Malik Azol, is from Brunei as well. You spoke in length about your lectures on how ASEANWAY is evolving and how there has been issues as well in terms of representation from grassroots. My question is mainly partly on young people. How currently ASEAN is being economically driven, previously by conflict, and young people, more than half the population, as you mentioned, is now transitioning as leaders of today, and they would reflect that in the market. You know, as you say, the ASEAN identity is there. How do you expect that us young people to adopt that intrinsically, ASEANWAY as something we want to actually represent in ourselves, and how that would reflect that later for policymakers and industry leaders.
Okay, excellent.
I think.
Oh, sorry. Excellent. So should we clarify a few? Yeah, no. I know you're very keen to do this one, but perhaps I don't know where Jenny's gone, but perhaps in front here.
Hi, I'm Mint. I'm still studying in sixth form, but hoping to study at LSE next year. You spoke a lot about the comparisons to the EU and finding an ASEAN identity. In the EU, the majority of the countries have Christianity as their core religion, and perhaps this contributed significantly in finding a core values in the past and forming an EU identity. However, this is not necessarily the case in ASEAN. For example, Islam and Buddhism, where some of the fundamental beliefs and cultures are different and contributes to the country's governance. Of course, this makes it more difficult. So how would you propose a way to approach this difference that is so deep-rooted in a country's identity in trying to form an ASEAN identity?
Thank you very much. Bringing in the religion dimension. Thank you. Now, the gentleman in the back, in the middle, in the black shirt. And then I'll come to the two of you later. Okay, thank you.
Hi there. Thanks very much for your talk tonight. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm going to be a bit cheeky and ask on Thai domestic politics, if I may. In terms of the referendum that's coming up on the constitution, you've obviously been quite understandably so ambivalent about the proposals. What are your views on the prospect of a kind of pre-electoral pact between the different parties? So if it was to come into force, which, let's be honest, with referendums in Thailand on, you know, constitutions get passed, whatever the minutiae of the actual constitution, rather. Do you think there's scope for some sort of pact between all the parties, Pu-Thai, the major parties, so you could actually take it out and propose a new constitution to replace it?
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your question. All right, so we'll do a round and then we'll come back.
Keep going.
Do you want him to? okay, we'll take
we'll
the round
right,
now.
Right?
Yeah,
okay.
We'll take this round and then I'll come back.
Okay, I'll try to be as brief as possible. I'll go to that question first. It's a good observation about the religious dimension and the differences or diversity, but I think mostly we are trying to separate the state from religion already. So it shouldn't in itself be something that would prevent us coming up with some kind of common values or identity. Just give you an example that if you go around the border areas in Thailand, you know, it's not just religion, but it could be language, It could be, other differences. And yet you will find they have no problems. You know, the people who live along the border, to have their own kind of agreements on how they live and exchange and trade with each other. Not always actually sticking to the rule books. Both sides of the border have written. Mm-hmm. So the proximity in itself should be something that we think about. And this comes to your question now that, well, if we want to build on the ASEAN way, we have to come up with alternatives. Mm. You know, if member countries are still reluctant to say, well, we'll adopt the sort of human rights charter or whatever, well, how about the idea that, well, in Asia, we are a caring community? What does a caring community mean? What it entails in terms of practices, making sure that no one is harmed, driving, being driven towards equality because of the caring dimension. I mean, this is an example. And I'm sure, you'll be able to come up with many, many more that is in character with Asian, East Asian or Southeast Asian people. And some of these issues will sidestep the differences. You know, yes, well, religions are different, but there is a common core of what religion wants to achieve in terms of how people practice in their lives. And we just take the common values and use them to overcome the differences. Now, the domestic question. Well, it's precisely because of a number of complicating factors that I have made a statement that I disagree with the draft constitution, but have stopped short of urging people to say we should reject. Three reasons. Number one, we don't even know what the alternative is. It's a little odd for me, and I've not succeeded in convincing my government that the people have the right to know what happens if there is a rejection. I mean, this is almost like a game show, you know. Hmm. You take this or you get the one behind the door. But that's not how you should be asking people to decide on the highest law of the land. Hmm. If I urge people to say no because I disagree with the Constitution and I end up with the worst one, I mean, how should I? I mean, what would be my responsibility? Mm. Second, we are the general sentiment of the people. Well, for one thing, is not many of them have read the Constitution, right? Mm. That's not odd. It's what you would expect. You know, I remember being in a luncheon with the European ambassadors, and they were asking me that, how can you expect the people of Thailand to read the constitution, know the provisions, and make an informed decision? And my reply was, well, how do you expect the British people to read all these treaties with the European Union to make an informed decision on whether to leave or remain? It's a political decision that you're asking people to make, not really a technical decision as such. And what we feel is a lot of people are either not really well aware of what's being written. Many of them are not happy with the Constitution, but prefer the certainty of moving ahead and are willing to say yes so that we can move on. Especially towards elections. I mean, that's the overwhelming sentiment from, you know, all the people I meet in all the regions of Thailand, whether they're happy with the constitution or not, happy with the military or not. Mm. There's this sense that at the moment a rejection could bring not just uncertainty, but instability. And you can't deny the fact that a portion of people who are campaigning no have already said that if they win in the referendum, they will be asking the military or Khun Prayut to leave, to show responsibility. We don't think that that's the best path for Thailand either. We don't need any more instability or uncertainty. And therefore, you have to play off the imperfections of the constitution with what available options you have. And you actually are very astute to say that there are a number of options. Mm. So if political parties were to make a pact, they don't even have to make a pact. They just have to make a public stance that can sidestep some of the problematic provisions, then maybe that's a solution for the country. So for me, at the moment, I'm stopping short of saying yes or no, because I think these factors are in play. I will do my best still to ask the military to tell us what the options are. I'm going to be insistent that I would not join any campaign to destabilize the country, and I want the country to move ahead. And if we can all agree that we're trying to get the best constitution for the country, that's the best thing. But if it's all politicized, if people are going to make decisions based on who they like, who they don't like, that's not going to serve the country in the medium and long term. And the last thing Thailand needs is to be discussing or drafting yet another constitution 2-3 years from now. Mm-hmm. We have so many challenges to deal with. And the sooner this issue is behind us, the better.
Interesting. Excellent. Okay. We're going to take another round of questions now. If I may, just quickly thank you for that very measured, thoughtful response to this question about domestic politics. It just really sets the right tone. I wanted to also say, just make a quick remark about your response to the question about Asia, that we are a caring society, and that's absolutely true. And another dimension of that is the importance of family.
Yes.
You know, in so many Asian cultures, so many Asian polities, we view, you know, semblances of the government or ruling class as being an extension of the family in a way that the West can never understand. They find it completely alien. And it sets apart, you know, for a long time there was a discussion, in particular in relation to Singapore, and Lee Kuan Yew's assertion that there were Asian values, and many Western critics said there was no such thing. But of course there are, just as there are also European values, as the question pointed out. Okay, so the two gentlemen here in succession.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Good evening. My name's Eri. I am half Thai Indonesian, and thank you for your speech tonight.
Yeah.
I'm going to visit. So I would like to ask a question regarding the fact that I experienced myself living in Thai and Indonesia in both of my lifespan. I would like to ask whether there is some kind of agreements towards intercultural, how should I say it, a more freer movement towards ASEAN people to integrate with the society and each other. Because what I see is if we encourage more people moving towards the region and have more connectivity, I think that's going to improve the image and ultimately get into the goal of creating an ASEAN image. So with your proposal of connectivity, I want to know what kind of proposal you're giving to ultimately reach this goal. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The gentleman behind.
Yeah. Thank you. Esteemed leader, Professor Kwa, good evening. So my name is Jason Wong, and I'm an alumnus of the London School of Economics. So I guess a question to the esteemed leader would be that what would be your vision for ASEAN going forward? As in, for example, in 10 or 20 years' time, what do you foresee ASEAN being? Because I noted earlier in your speech, you have mentioned that Obviously, with ASEAN, there were a lot of fissions, for example, with it becoming a monetary union, which obviously was dropped after the Greek crisis. But to what extent do you think ASEAN should be integrated as a whole? And what kind of interconnectivity do you think would be suitable for a geographic region such as that of ASEAN? So that's the first part of my question. And then in terms of the second part of the question, I would say is that what kind of international recognition does ASEAN seek to achieve? Because we see that with regards to, for example, America, they're having TPP, and we see that China One Belt One Road is obviously a very bold initiative which has caught the world's attention. But what kind of recognition does ASEAN seek to achieve in this regard? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. We can take one more before I close down this round. Otherwise, you know, we actually do have three questions. So,
okay.
Would you like to?
Okay. Well, the first point on connectivity is I think something we can easily and completely agree with. Well, it's been said that AirAsia has been one of the main contributors to the ASEAN community, maybe more so than some of the intergovernmental agreements.
Yeah, Tony Fernandez says that all the time.
Well, you would. but there's a point there.
Yeah.
And when I talked about ASEAN brand and that sort of stuff, it's something that brings people together in practical terms. And in terms of freedom of movement, well, a number of things need to change. First of all, there are already agreements on certain professions, I think 8 altogether, where there is supposed to be a liberalized regime. But there are so many practical obstacles in the way. For instance, if you were a doctor in other countries in ASEAN, not in Thailand, and you wanted to practice in Thailand, yes, you have that right. But you have to comply with our internal law, which means you need a license. And to get that license, you have to take an exam in Thai. So you have to learn Thai before you can you get that. But it's these sort of obstacles which we'll have to seek ways in which to remove them if we want to encourage freedom of movement. Secondly, I mean, a much bigger question, the issue of unskilled labor. So far we're talking about the professions, which is actually politically easier. But on the issue of unskilled labor, well, my country has been in a situation of labor shortage for quite some time now. And yet somehow we have not had the political courage to change the regime on how we treat guest workers. So I would say that there are about 6 million guest workers in Thailand, but only about a third of that would be legal. We're not being realistic, okay? And we are a fast-aging society, and we will need unskilled and semi-skilled labor from many neighboring countries. So I think the way to move forward is to remove these obstacles, and we'll need a change of mindset from policymakers and also people. It's not easy. If it were, you wouldn't have Donald Trump talking about building a wall. So it's not just an ASEAN thing.
Yeah.
And the struggle that you have here in Europe. What would be an efficient way? I mean, you were saying, Is it a common currency? Is it well, I think one of the things about the ASEAN way is we have to be pragmatic. And we shouldn't, I think, set in stone that we have to have a common currency for it to be a truly integrated community. I think we should take what's practical. We should take the low-hanging fruits and steadily build on that, but with some kind of common theme. You know, I like your addition of the family values in addition to the caring concept. So we seek out these principles and common concepts and use them to apply to specific areas which are appropriate for the situation. I think it also reflects the way ASEAN think and part of the ASEAN way in the past, and we should build on that. Recognition. I think we'd like to see ourselves as continuing to be one of the most dynamic region economically. Growth rates, stability. And also, we'd like to be recognized as a region that helps provide platforms for everybody else in the world to tackle some common challenges. You know, security issues, through the ARF, maybe, you know, health, common health challenges that we'll face more and more. We provide that platform, and we have, you know, all the major powers in the East Asia structure and also the ARF. And somehow, if we can complete the triangle, if you like, build something up with the European Union, then I think we'll be well placed to be recognized as being such.
Okay, final round of questions. While they're waiting, can I press you? Jenny, excellent. Sorry, I didn't see you. Jenny, go ahead.
I don't know whether other people are, maybe in the audience, know this better than I do, but of course we've compared things to the EU over this evening, and we do have that free movement within countries. My experience in Southeast Asia is that there are a lot of people working in other nations, sending money home to their families, but I mean, how difficult is that to do? Do you have the free, free travel within the nations? Is that something that can be done easily, or is that purely by profession, like you mentioned earlier? And if it is purely by profession, how long do you think that would be until that could come into play, and would it help with the ASEAN community?
Yeah, excellent.
Well, it will certainly help, and you say what the situation is. And as I mentioned quickly, as a rough estimate, that maybe twice the number of people working as guest workers are actually illegal than there are legal. And when you are there illegally, there are two things that I'm not happy with. Number one, that opens up the way for so much corruption on the part of officials. You know, because if you want to stay, you pay the officials and so on, they get exploited. And two, what that creates is that the guest workers will not appreciate the opportunities that Thailand is giving them. They're just here to earn an income, send the money home, but feel they've not been well treated. We should be encouraging guest workers to come and work and actually want to be part of our society. And if we can do that, I think that will make huge contributions to having an ASEAN community. But as I say, it's a difficult issue. I mean, I mentioned the US and the European countries. Many people are still uncomfortable with the idea of people coming over from other countries and being part of their society. When it's, you know, if we talk about global community or regional community, that's what it means. And if you can't change that mindset, it's not going to happen.
And there are senses in which this is a problem across Asia, even outside ASEAN. Japan desperately needs more workers, but the idea of letting in a free flow of workers at different skill levels is anathema, would be political suicide for many.
It's hard enough getting rice into Japan.
Yeah, and Thailand would know. Other questions? If not, I think it's a good opportunity for me to, well, first, thank all of you in the audience for your interest, you know, participation. The questions have been really excellent. Everyone's been really good. And I wanted to check with you. I know that you have a car waiting. But
I hope so, yes.
Yeah. But the issue is whether we need to keep everyone here or... I know that there are no views. Okay, so I will just simply say I want to thank you for such a delicate, intelligent dissection of a really difficult, complicated issue. You have unpacked for us the ASEAN way in a manner that now helps the rest of us
think about the steep problems that are going to come ahead. And it remains for me to ask the audience to join me in thanking Khun Abhisit for this evening.